I think no matter what your system is, no matter what system you have in place, you constantly have to have a way to evaluate that system. So just because you were successful last month, last quarter, yesterday, it does not have any impact on the future.
This is To The Point. A Rhino Experience. Voted one of the top home services marketing and operations podcasts. Cutting through the bullshit and getting to the point.
First, what I want to do is I want to go ahead and bring up Sebastian from Rillo. Sebastian, where are you at? He's the most shy guy in the room.
Yes, sir.
I got to spend a little bit of time with Sebastian over the last few months. And then ironically, you know, I was partnered with Gary Vee for 3 years and he came in to do an event and you invited me to it. I met you, hung out. And I was like, what is all this Rillo Voice stuff? And then I learned what it was. It's an incredibly cool product. I know that some of our big players in here use them. I know that Steve from Capos, you guys, Steve and Matt, you guys use them in the roofing space. There's quite a few in here that use it. It's a really cool tool. And when we're talking about making decisions like on working in the business right now and fixing some of the things, maybe it's in your sales process, this is a great tool to help do those things. So congratulations on building a badass product.
Thank you, my man.
And I'm excited because these guys pulled this together. Like normally I handle all the talent. They handled the talent on this one and they got Coach Saban. So well done, I'm excited. I'm bummed I don't get to do the Q&A, but I saw the questions, you're gonna do it justice. So Sebastian, to you guys, thank you, brother, and crush it. And by the way, don't mess up the questions.
Amazing.
You're welcome.
Amazing, so right on. So for those of you who don't know me, and for those of you who do know me and are sick and tired of seeing my face, hello again. And for those of you who don't know me, I am Sebastian. I am the founder and CEO of this wonderful company called Rillo Voice. We are the leading speech analytics software for the home improvement industry. As I said this morning, what that means is when your technicians, comfort advisors go into homes and talk to homeowners, they record their conversations, they talk to homeowners, and we use AI to automatically transcribe, analyze, and give them feedback to help them improve their sales and how they talk and what they say, and to help you, coaches in the room, do what we call virtual ride-alongs that are 100 times faster, better, and more productive than ever before. Now, and I just have to do this so that we can pay for this, if you are not on the Rillo Voice train, take out your phone, put it to the QR code right here, and put your company, your name, your email, your phone number, and book a demo with our highly trained sales consultants so you can learn more about Rillo. Now that I have the money covered, thank you, I have the wonderful pleasure of introducing and bringing to you guys today at RhinoX your keynote speaker. And I want to talk a little bit about why we got this speaker today, because this is very special for us. So a lot of you, I would say about 60% of you, are using Rillo today. And you guys are seeing some great results, upwards of 50% increases in conversion rates and average tickets and tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue growth and EBITDA. And people always ask us in demos when they meet us, like, Sebastian, you know, this Rillo thing sounds great. How is it possible that a simple tool can help drive so much growth for a company? And we say it's not the tool, it's about the coaches using the tool. It's all about the coaches, you know? And at Rillo, we like to say that sales is a highly competitive sport. Anybody who's seen our demos knows that. Sales is a highly competitive sport where you need amazing coaches, like some of you in the room today. You need superstar players that are naturally talented. And you need a lot of infield coaching and training to help, you know, take what your superstars are doing and bring it into a championship winning system that can be followed by everybody in your team, not only your superstars, so that they can play consistently well week in, week out. You know, so you can actually develop a championship winning team. The problem in the sport of sales that we play is that there is a fundamental lack of visibility when you're out there playing. Because, you know, if you think of the best team of all time, right? Think of the best team of all time. It could be Alabama football. It could be the Patriots with Tom Brady, Phil Jackson and the Bulls, right? Imagine you go back in time and you tell that coach, you say, coach, we're going to let you coach your players in the dressing room and give them tactics and playbooks and feedback and drills. We're going to let you track results and see if you're winning games and losing games, but we're not going to let you be on the field when the game is going on. When the game is happening, you can't be on the field, you can't see it on TV, you can't review the game film, you can't see the game at all. Do you think that team would win all those championships with this handicap? The answer is probably not. And that is the unfortunate reality of playing the sport of home service sales today, that we can coach our players, and we give them service systems, and scorecards and role-playing and objection handling techniques, and we use ServiceTitan to track results, our average tickets, our conversion rates, everything. But at the end of the day, we can't actually see the game of sales, because the only way to do that, of course, is doing a ride-along, a physical ride-along. And you have one manager, 10 technicians, you can't be everywhere at once. So what ends up happening, unfortunately, is that you're spending all this money in marketing to get calls and all this money developing CSR so you can book the appointments. And then the entire top line of your entire business is based on a conversation where 98% of the time you have no idea what the hell is going on there, right? So when people ask us about Rilla and why it's so great, we say it's not just Rilla. It's the fact that Rilla allows your coaches to actually be in the field and do game film analysis and do coaching every single day, every single time that your technicians are playing the game of sales, just like every other major coach in every other major sport. So today, we want to do something really special. We want to honor the tradition of great coaches. We want to honor the coaches who use Rilla, like Dave Geiger and Josh Campbell, Tommy Mello, Aaron Gaynor. And we want to honor the great coaches of home services. And those of you who know us a little bit know that at Rilla, we have a particular proclivity to booking amazing speakers. Like Chris was saying, we booked Gary Vee at Pantheon. We booked Jocko Willink at Nexstar Super Meeting. And for RhinoX, we said, well, this is the most premier event in home services. How can we level up our game and grow a pair of big cojones and give our customers and our coaches the most premier experience that they've ever seen? What better way to do that than by booking one of the greatest coaches of all time? Let's play the video.
How do you begin to tell your story? It's hard to imagine that one man could change a university, a program, a town, and a team as much as you have. But here you are. Your story started on a tarmac in Tuscaloosa, and sure, there were some challenges to overcome. You believed in the process.
And what I would like for every football team to do that we play is to sit there and say, I hate playing against these guys.
Little did anyone know, 2009 would end up with a crystal ball in Pasadena and the first Heisman Trophy in school history. The
Heisman Trophy is awarded to Mark Ingram.
But it wasn't just the trophies you were after. You cared for this town and its people. When disaster struck in 2011 and a tornado tore through Tuscaloosa, you and Miss Terry were the ones who believed you could rebuild. You didn't run from adversity. You attacked it. Sure, LSU won the first time in 2011.
LSU remains undefeated.
But not the second.
LSU and Alabama.
Your back was against the wall so many times that you and your team fought its way out.
We control it right here.
2012.
Celebrations begin. Alabama wins.
2015, the Alabama Brotherhood means something. Just look at 2017. Jalen cared about one thing, the team.
Wouldn't be surprised if he gets a shot.
And Tua entered. And then, magic.
Tagovailoa trying to make up for it. Fires to the end zone. Touchdown! Alabama wins!
But as you always have, you saw the bigger picture. And in 18, the roles were reversed, and you had an unwavering belief in your players like you always have.
I'm so proud of this guy for what he's done this year, I can't even tell you.
Fast forward to 2020. You saw a time where you had to stand for something. You listened, trusted your players, stood with them, and they believed in you. It ended with more hardware. But the hardware was never what you were chasing, was it, Coach? No, you were after the relationships, the growth, the standard, the love of the game. And not to mention, you had a heck of an assistant coach to help you do it. But now, Coach Saban, the next chapter of your life begins.
Roll Tide, baby. Here we go.
And you get to do the one thing that maybe you aren't great at. Rest. Maybe the whistle won't be around your neck and the headset is tucked away. And now, instead of coach, you'll hear Papaw, Dad, Brother, and Nick. Your process may change. The process you taught so many, that will live on forever. Coach, what you've built isn't going anywhere. The standard isn't going anywhere. And believe it or not, your story is still being written. So as you embark on your next journey, continue to enjoy the memories. Cherish the moments. Continue to love the process. And as you said best, Coach, this isn't the end. This is the beginning.
I want everybody here to know this is not the end. This is the beginning.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the greatest football coach of all time, Coach Saban.
Good to see you. Great.
Thank you. Thank you all. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Right on. Roll Tide.
I love this group, man. I like these small group settings. Makes me feel like the team, like we have a team in the team room, and we're going to talk to the team, so we'll do that.
We're going to review some game film, man. Let's do it.
Yeah, good.
So, super quickly, how we like to run these at Rilla, these events are for you. We try to serve the industry, so I am going to set the stage. I'm going to ask Coach Saban a few questions to set the stage, and like we always do it, we're going to hand it to the floor so that you guys can, you know, all the business challenges that you guys have right now, the business problems. This is one of the best leaders of teams that we have in the room here today. And he knows all about processes and coaching and leading. So whatever business challenges you guys have today, please take that from your minds into your mouths, into the mic, so that we can ask Coach Saban all of these wonderful questions. So I will set the stage and get started, and then the floor is yours. So everybody good? Right on. Awesome. So Coach, anytime anybody says the words Coach Saban, it is impossible not to hear the words process right after. The process, right? And your athletes, they talk about the process. And even athletes who didn't coach with you, they talk about the process, and they do it very emotionally and angry. And your wife, Miss Terry, talks about the process. And you yourself took your process from the football field and brought it into one of the most successful car dealerships in the country that you're running today. So Coach, tell us about this legendary process. What is the process?
Yeah, well, the process is a definition of what you have to do to be successful and accomplish the goals that you have. It's as simple as that. You know, I think you all probably have a vision, just like we had a vision of what we wanted to accomplish and what we wanted to do to win a championship in football. And now you got to say, okay, let's define what that entails. What does that entail? Just like every player on our team, when I meet with a player on our team, I ask them, what do you want to accomplish while you're here at the University of Alabama? What's your goals? What's your aspirations? What do you want to accomplish? Guy says, I want to graduate and I want to play in the NFL someday. My next question is, do you know what that entails? And most guys can't answer that. So the process is simply the answer to that question. Here is what you have to do to graduate from college or accomplish any vision that you have. Here's what you have to do to play in the NFL. Now, but once you establish this, you have to have the discipline to execute it every day. And I think this is what people probably struggle with the most is, you know, people talk about discipline all the time. What is discipline? Do what you're supposed to do, when you're supposed to do it, the way it's supposed to get done, do the right thing, the right way, the right time, all the time. Great definitions of discipline. But self-discipline, I'm talking about self-discipline, comes down to two questions. that you ask yourself, we all ask ourselves 100 times a day. Here's something I know I'm supposed to do that I really don't want to do. Can you make yourself do it? Then over here, there's something you know you're not supposed to do, but you want to do it. Can you keep yourself from it? So if you can have that self-discipline, once we define what it takes, what does it take to accomplish these goals, this vision that we have? Now we have the discipline to execute it every day. It's simple. You know, let's just say I wanted to lose 10 pounds. That's my goal. That's my vision. SlimFast defines the process of what I can do to that. So how am I going to fail? In 3 days, I'm eating pie and ice cream again. So, but I made a choice and decision to do that. So how many times do you hear people in your organization, people on your team, or even you yourself, or your kids, your children, say, I don't feel like studying. I don't feel like going to work today. So we're trying to accomplish the bridge between feeling versus choice. Okay, we have this vision. All right, you're going to focus on circumstances and how you feel, or are you going to be able to focus on what you need to do to accomplish and make the choices and decisions to accomplish the goals that you have? So if you can cross that bridge, you have a much better chance to be successful. And, you know, you can self-assess every day and just say to yourself, if I do this, what's going to happen? If I don't do this, what's going to happen? That's the answer to the question right there. Are you doing the things you need to do in terms of being able to self-assess? But you have to define the vision, and you have to define, what do I have to do to accomplish what I've set out to do? That's the process. All right, so you put it down and you define it. And look, you need to define it in your organization. We define it. It makes the culture. It defines the culture of your organization because everybody buys into the same principles and values. So if you're going to have a team that works together, you have to define that. That makes the team what it is. You know, we don't have any signs up in for 17 years, for 25 years as a head coach, it says, win a national championship. We don't have any signs in the building that says that. We don't have any signs in the building that says, win the SEC. Those are all result-oriented type goals. All right. We have a sign in the building that says, be a champion. So now we are defining what you have to do as an individual and what we have to do as a team to win a championship. That's focusing on the process, not the outcome. Right. We're going to focus on what does it take to do to get the outcome that we want and stay focused on that. Like all these questions I get asked all the time, and you had some of them in what you sent me, they were all outcome-oriented questions. Like the outcome affects you. Whether you win, what do? You lose, what do? If you have a defined process, if you have a defined, this is the culture, this is what we have to do to be a champion. So let's fix what we didn't do to be a champion. Got to be a team. Everybody's got to be together. Everybody can accomplish more. We got to have respect and trust in the organization to be able to do that. Everybody needs to be positive about their attitude and their work. So, you know, attitudes are contagious. You want to make sure everybody in the organization wants to make sure that what they got is worth catching. So it affects other people. And then you got to have accountability in your organization. So people have to be responsible for their own self-determination. So you define this process. So now you got to be responsible and accountable to it. And then you got to want to dominate the competition and be willing to work and do the basic things that you have to do to dominate the competition, whatever the competition is. I'm talking about a football game now. I mean, we do it in Mercedes. We do it in whatever we're going to do. Got to have the work ethic. You're going to reap what you sow. You got to have the persistence to stick with things, all right, because there's going to be ups and downs all the time. You got to be positive. You know, people always say, You know, when I became positive in 1986, I was at a banquet, and a priest was sitting beside me who did the benediction. And he says, "I got a book I want you to read." I said, "Oh, yeah?" He says, "It's about spiritual development and positive attitude." I said, "Okay, what's the name of the book? I'll get it." He said, "The Road Less Traveled." I said, "Okay, I'm going to get that book." So I get the book, and I open it up. The first line in the book says, "Life is difficult." I'm saying, priest is crazy. But when you read the book is about, if we expect everything to be like perfect every day, and that we're not going to have issues, and we're not going to have problems, and we're not going to have to solve things, and it's not going to take some perseverance to be able to execute, you know, on a consistent basis, we're always going to be disappointed, because those things are going to happen every day. Okay, so for the last 25 years, I've got over 100 adolescents on our team. Over 100. On a college campus. So do you think I should go to work every day thinking nobody's going to mess up? Nobody's going to make a bad choice. Nobody's going to make a bad decision. Everybody's going to do exactly what they're supposed to do. Yeah. If I thought that, I would be miserable. Miserable. So I don't think that. I think there are going to be issues today. There are going to be problems to solve. So I can stay positive in how I want to approach those things. That's important to being successful. You know, accountability, being responsible for your own self-determination. Everybody in the organization needs to do that. But it takes leadership. You know, we all need to be inspirational teachers in terms of what we do. And you have to institute leadership and how you affect people to be able to do that.
Right.
All right, but there's different kinds of leadership. All right, it's, you can be a laissez-faire leader. Like, yeah, I'm the boss here. All right, so you ought to do what you're supposed to do because I'm the boss. You should be trying to please me. I'm doing really nothing to impact you in a positive way or a negative way, but I'm just going to kind of let it happen. All right, then you can have transactional leadership, which has some benefits, because if you're transactional and everything goes good, you're going to reinforce the people who made it go good, correct? Which they need. It's one of the most basic needs we all have, is to get positive reinforcement. If you get criticized and have no input, it's the worst thing that can happen relative to morale. Okay, but this transactional guy is going to also confront you and criticize you when things don't go well. So I'm for the transformational type leader. Okay, the transformational type leader, which is the way we always tried to do it, is A, put a responsibility on yourself to be somebody that somebody can emulate. So you're going to set a good example in everything that you do. So you're not expecting everybody else to work if you're not going to work that hard. You're not expecting anybody else to do anything that you're not willing to do. So you're going to set a good example, and you're going to help other people to benefit them. You're not to benefit you, that's manipulation, to benefit them. And they have to know that. So how do you do that? You got to develop relationships. You got to inspire the people. You got to engage with them. You got to talk to them. You got to listen. You got to try to understand things from their perspective. So you are actually teaching accountability. We don't think sometimes as leaders that, yeah, we're going to define the process and we're going to do all that, but are we really going to teach accountability? We're going to demand accountability, but are we going to teach people how to be accountable? Well, if you're going to be a good leader, you need to engage with the people, all right, so that you can teach them to be accountable and not just assume that they're going to be accountable.
Right. I mean, is that this concept of transformational leadership that you're talking about and keeping people accountable, like one of the most fascinating things, like just like reading your story and watching you in action, is that this process that you just like literally outlined for everybody, those are very simple things, right?
Very simple things.
Like anybody can follow. But not everybody has 7 championships, right? nobody at all, right? And I think, and correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of the secret sauce in your life has been not just getting the process, but getting people to buy in, especially
That's right.
college students that have their own ambitions, their own egos, their own goals. You know, like my sales team, they're all D1 athletes. They told me that when we were playing Bama, man, we know that those people were a unit. Like, I was trying to get to the NFL. Everybody's, those guys are trying to follow the process. They're trying to follow their coach. And one of the biggest problems that a lot of the people in the room have is exactly that. They have their process outlined. They have their systems. And then how do I get my technicians to follow and just buy in? Is this how you got it done, the transformational leadership and not demanding?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you make it about them. You know, everybody says there's no I in team. There's an I in win. And that I stands for the individuals, because the individuals make the team what it is. And you just referenced it. You said everybody's selfish, everybody's self-absorbed, everybody's talking about what they got to do. Well, take advantage of that. I'll give you an example. Okay, so we had this guy, I'm not going to mention his name, but he was the eighth guy picked in the draft when he was a senior, but when he was a freshman, he's a linebacker, and he was a very good leader on the team. When he's a freshman, he's walking by a fraternity, you know, on a Friday night. Good kid, not doing anything wrong. The people in the fraternity yell racial slurs at him or whatever, so he goes and gets in a confrontation, gets in a fight with these guys at this fraternity. So the police bring him to me rather than arresting him. So I have him sit in my office and I say, man, you can't do stuff like this. You can't be a part of Alabama's football program and represent this organization, this university, and this team and make these kinds of choices and decisions. And he about jumps across the table with me and puts his fist on the table like this and says, hey, coach, where I come from, when people say these kind of things to you, you got to defend your honor and your pride, and I'm just not going to take that from anybody. I said, okay, I get it. He said, so, look, you're going to be a first-round draft pick someday. You're starting as a freshman. You got all the measurables. You're going to be a first-round draft pick someday. So if this cop would have arrested you tonight and you got an assault charge against you, that would be a huge character flaw for you. So instead of making $30 million as a first-round draft pick, you'd get dropped to the third round, and you'd make $3 million. So even though I agree with what you're saying, is it worth $27 million to be right? And the guy perks up and says, you won't ever have another problem with me again. So my point is, you make it about the individuals, and you show them how this sacrificing for the team and giving up your own selfish goals and aspirations for the team will also help you create the value for yourself that will actually help you be more successful, because these values are going to enhance the success. But you make it about them and how they can be successful, and that was the original plan of having every guy on the team come in and say, tell me what your goals and aspirations are. Because now I can relate everything that that guy does to what he originally told me. So guy tells me he wants to graduate and play in the NFL someday. Misses class, doesn't want to, comes in and says, I don't feel like practicing today. Call him in my office and say, hey, you told me you wanted to graduate. How's this behavior enhancing you graduating? You don't want to practice today, but you want to play in the NFL. How's this behavior? So you're just making it about them in terms of how what they want to accomplish they can do through the team, but at the same time, their behavior is not enhancing or is enhancing their chances to do it.
And does this require, this sounds like this requires an incredible amount of time and patience to really get to know the individuals in the team. And
I mean, right. Well, that's a part of this transformational type of leadership. When I talked about, you got to listen, you got to communicate, you got to have relationships with people, and it takes time. But you can't just assume that everybody's buying in and everybody's going to do things exactly the way you want to do them. And you got to listen. You got to listen. You know, I always had a leadership group on our team where we'd have 9 or 10 players. And sometimes I would just call them in and say, what do you think we ought to do about this? Like, I never set curfews. All these championship games we had, everybody always says, you got a curfew? I mean, I have moms ask me all the time in recruiting, do you have a curfew? I didn't have a curfew. I told the players, what's curfew? You set the curfew, then it's your curfew, and you get them to... I never made any curfews.
Because it makes them accountable to their
own. It makes them accountable to each other and that they had some input in whatever it is they had to do. So, but I'd ask them sometimes, player has a behavior issue. I think it's going to affect the team if I keep the guy on the team. I don't like to get rid of players on the team because it's kind of a life sentence, so to speak. So I try to figure out ways that we can rehabilitate them some kind of way, behavior-wise. And once you invest in them, then you get that back. You know, it's a good investment. So I might ask the leadership group, what do you think we ought to do with this guy? So they have input, and you're listening to what they have to say. Now, I can probably talk them into whatever I want them to do at the same time, but at least they think that they have some input into what's happening in the organization and the process itself.
I want to ask you just a few more questions and then open it up to the floor. One of the things that I think made you really great is like your obsession with detail and making sure, like you share this this phrase with your good friend Bill Belichick of getting everyone to do your job, right?
Yeah.
And you're famous, and I wanted to ask you about this for your obsession with game film. I heard a story, I don't know if this is true, that you guys won a championship on a Monday, and then on a Tuesday or Wednesday, you were back with the coaching staff analyzing the game film of the game that you had just won, trying to identify what were the areas of improvement. And I wanted to ask you, how much of your time, I mean, you're spending a lot of time getting to know these players, getting to understand their motivations, putting them in the right way. How much of your time that you devote to actually analyzing game film, and how critical would you say that was to your success?
In home services, speed to lead is everything. Chirp stands out by transforming your communication strategy. With Chirp, accelerate your lead response time with instant SMS text messaging, email, and ringless voicemail automation. Chirp's cutting-edge technology ensures you're the first and the most persistent, helping you close more deals than ever. But that's not all. Say goodbye to missed opportunities with Chirp's incredible follow-up system. Keep your leads engaged and moving smoothly through your sales funnel without lifting a finger. And with Chirp, deep integrations with top CRMs like ServiceTitan, Housecall Pro, and Jobber, you can launch laser-targeted campaigns to connect with the exact right leads at the exact right time. Automation creates efficiency. Efficiency unlocks scalability. With Chirp, you can automate speed to lead, estimate follow-ups, rehash, abandoned call follow-ups, canceled job follow-ups, review requests, outbounding to your list, annual reminders, membership expiration follow-ups, and so much more. So stop chasing leads. Capture them. Connect faster and close more deals with Chirp. Contact Chirp today and elevate your communication game.
Well, I think, you know, we talk about self-assessing. I think no matter what your system is, no matter what system you have in place, you constantly have to have a way to evaluate that system. And so if you're going to improve, that's what you need to do. And look, success is not a continuum. So just because you were successful last month, last quarter, yesterday, it does not have any impact on the future, right? So history is kind of history, and you're not focused on that. Just like, yeah, we won a championship on Monday, right? We traveled home on Tuesday. On Wednesday, we analyzed what we did well and what we didn't do well in the game. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
I mean, in every game that we have, as much as we won, we always have good plays that we show and reinforce positive performance, but we also show bad plays and how those could have impacted the game and how they don't create value for the players that made those mistakes, or it doesn't create value for the team. So we call it good, bad, and ugly. So we're constantly evaluating so that we can get better, because success is not a continuum. It's momentary. And if you don't continue to try to improve whatever your product is, whatever your organization is, whatever your process is, you have to adapt because things change. Things change. So dinosaurs couldn't adapt, they died. All right, so if you don't adapt and you don't change as time goes on, you're not going to be able to continue to be successful. All right, just like in a 15-year period, just to give you an idea of how things have changed. 15 years ago, we struggled with no huddle. All right, when we played against a no huddle fastball team, we struggled. The defensive players were used to getting the call that told them what to do, what the front was, what the coverage was against 2x2, 3x1, empty, whatever it was. We told them everything, but we told them in a huddle. Now there is no huddle. So now their routine is shattered. Their routine is shattered. Now you got to make one word calls. You can't make a, you know, Oaky flex six bump Bronco. You can't say those five words because the other team's, so that's got to be just Buckeye and everybody's got to be able to relate to that. Okay, so that was a huge change 15 years ago because everybody was used to being in the huddle. Michigan is the first team that we played in the playoffs this year for 2 years that got in the huddle. So now our players are whacked out about playing a team that gets in a huddle because they're not used to getting in a huddle. They're used to getting a one-word call. They see the formation. They know what to do, and it's all said and done. Now these people are coming out of the huddle, and they're looking like, what do I do? So my point about can you adapt? You know, can you make changes? Well, if you're not constantly self-assessing and you're constantly looking at what you have to do to improve, look, we're all trying to climb the mountain, right? Everybody's trying to do what they have to do to have the best organization, the best company, be number one, whatever you want to call it. So you can visualize it athletically. We just put the schedule like going up the mountain. So you're climbing the mountain. Well, once you climb the mountain successfully, you become the mountain. Everybody wants to beat you. You become the standard. So now it's a different kind of motivation. You don't have something to prove. You got to figure out ways not to have complacency and how to continue to be successful. Complacency creates a blatant disregard for doing what's right. And the human condition is not to be successful. The human condition is to survive. Your salespeople, our salespeople, if they got to sell 10 cars, when they sell 10 cars, they want to go sit in their lazy boy, eat Tostitos, and drink beer. They're not trying to set the course record for that month of selling the most cars. Okay, that's because we're geared towards survival. So what we're trying to do, what I tried to do as a coach, was take people who wanted to survive, do what they had to do to get by, basically, which is the basic human instinct, and make them be the best they could be. And bridging that gap, you know, I call capability gap. This is what you're capable of. This is what you're, the level you're performing to, and this is what you're capable of. So, now, to me, this is where you had one of the questions you ask is, do you recruit talent?
Yeah.
Yeah, you recruit talent, but you can't recruit accountability. You got to create that. You got to develop that. You got to have a system in place that helps you get people, even though they're talented, that doesn't mean they want to be the best.
Right.
So you're trying to bridge the gap and help them be successful. So, and, you know, like I always use the phrase, your question was, do you recruit talent or what's more important, recruiting talent or developing it? Mm-hmm. Well, it's both are important because eventually you got to get the right people on the bus. You got to get the wrong people off the bus. Then you got to get the right people in the right seats so that everybody's doing what they're most capable of being able to make the greatest contribution to. So it's important to do both, to have talented people, but are these talented people really driven to be successful? We all know somebody. We all know somebody that was the smartest guy in the class, smartest person in the class. Whatever, that was not very successful. We all know somebody probably that was the greatest athlete in the school that was not very successful. So you can recruit talent, but you can't recruit accountability. You got to have a system that helps people develop that. And some people are not capable of doing that based on their hardwiring. And if they're not, you need to get them out of your organization. Because the worst thing you can have in your organization is you create a standard and you create a culture. Then everybody's got to buy into that standard and that culture.
Right.
Because mediocre people don't like high achievers, and high achievers don't like mediocre people. And if you let them coexist in the same organization, you're going to have issues. Because
yeah.
The guy that's a high achiever, you're going to give him all the work to do, and the people that don't do a good job, you're going to give them nothing. And this guy over here is going to start saying, why is he getting paid what I'm getting paid?
Right.
He's not doing anything, and I'm doing all this. And they're going to come to you and say, what's up? And then you got a problem.
How do you, I mean, you're famous for also like understanding that people make mistakes and coaching people through to learn through their mistakes and learn through their failures. And, but at the same time, you know, you have to be very clear what your standards are. How do you know when it's time to say like, hey, this person that I've been trying to coach and trying to develop and trying to get them to abide by my standard, when is it enough? And say like,
yeah, well, how do they respond? I mean, that's the key to the drill. I mean, look, you can't waste a failing. We can't do it individually, and you can't let people in your organization waste the failing. So you're constantly teaching when something doesn't go right, okay? Why did it not go right? What do we have to do to fix it? And how are we going to do it? How important is it to you to get it right? So that's we got to do that. So you can't waste a failing. I mean, we lose a national championship game. That's exactly what I tell the players after Clemson beat us on the last play of the game and whatever year it was. I said, hey, guys, you can't waste a failing. Mm. We got to learn everything that we can learn from this game so it doesn't happen again. That's the best opportunity for people to learn is when they don't have success, mm-hmm. because they're more willing to listen and learn. When people have success, mm-hmm. Sometimes they get complacent, sometimes they get big-headed, sometimes it's more difficult to get them to buy into what they have to do to be successful, because they look at you and say, hey coach, we just won the game 39-6. Why are you telling us we need to do all these other things?
Yeah.
Well, it's not, the standard's not created by who you played or the competition. The standard's created by the standard we have in our organization of how we want to do things, not by somebody else. So that's what you're trying to get people to understand and what you're trying to get people to do. You know, like Michael Jordan says, because I fail is why I succeed. Mm. You know, you can really have no great victories in life unless you have adversity. That's what makes it a great victory. That's why we should look at some of these things as opportunities. The greatest example I can give is when I coached at Ohio State in 1980 or 81, and we played Michigan at Michigan. And we had lost two games that season, which is too many when you're coaching at Ohio State. Woody Hayes was not the coach anymore. Earl Bruce was the coach. So we're going to play Michigan. We're all getting criticized. It's supposed to be the biggest game, big rivalry game. I mean, everybody, most of the time you got to pull the players apart in practice when you're playing this game. But we got lots of negative things, man. People are getting criticized in the press. Coaches are getting criticized. We didn't think we could win the game. Coaches didn't think they could win the game. Players weren't into it. Everybody's pointing a finger. It's the offense's fault. It's the defense's fault. I mean, because everybody's getting criticized. So we have a thing called a senior tackle on Friday before we go to play at Michigan. And first time Coach Hayes in the 2 years that I was there since he got fired ever came back and spoke to the team. And he says something that's the most simple thing I've ever heard. There can be no great victories in life unless there's tremendous adversity. And he equates this game that we're playing at Michigan with the war in the Pacific. The war in the Pacific is the greatest military victory of all time because of Pearl Harbor. The adversity that Pearl Harbor created made that the greatest military victory of all time. So he goes through, you're playing Michigan, they're number one, there's 105,000 people, it's snowing up there, it's cold. All these reasons that this is a great opportunity to have a great victory. So people quit looking at it from a negative standpoint, mm-hmm. we can't win, mm-hmm. and they started looking at it as this is a great opportunity to have a great victory. And you know, that's in 1981, how many years ago, 7 national championships, 11 SEC championships ago. That's still one of the things that I remember most in my coaching career is winning that game at Michigan, 14-9. Bo Schembechler was the coach. the way the players played, and how they responded to that. It's an opportunity to be successful. So if you don't have adversity, how can you have any great wins? So if you're getting frustrated just because you have things to overcome in your organization, how can you have any great success? So, does that make sense? I don't even know. Did I answer your question or
not? You answered amazingly. So I want to stop it there for me because I want to open up the floor to everybody. So we are going to have microphones going. If we can have one here, just raise your hands because we're going to have the microphones to you, and then we're going to have people speaking. So raise your hand who wants to speak, and then we'll get you a microphone. Let's get a microphone right here. Let's get a microphone right here. Let's get a microphone right there. In the middle, and then in the back. Let's get a microphone there. So I'm going to start with you, and then I'm going to go with there. And first question, let's go.
Stats are so important, right? And you have Billy Beane's book that came out in baseball about following the stats. And I'm watching baseball teams that follow the stats, and the managers aren't on the field. Some of them are not even managing the games anymore, because all the stats are filtered down and they're told what to do if this happens, if this happens, if this happens, right? So my question to you is, how much to win a championship energy do you put into the stats versus gut instinct?
Energy that I don't know if I understand the question.
So I'll repeat the question. So okay. So basically, so she's asking the concept of Moneyball, right? In baseball, you see a lot of these coaches managing, literally just getting stats filtered down through them, and it's just like robots. You're just like following the stats and stats. And the question was, how much emphasis do you put into the stats
analytics.
Of the game and the analytics,
versus
gut instinct and making decisions based on your gut?
Right. I've never been a big analytics person. Because the analytics tell you statistically, this is the percentages of times that it's 4th and 3 at the 40-yard line. If you go for it, you're going to make it 40% of the time. It doesn't give you the consequence of the 60% that you didn't make it. Mm. Does that make sense? Yeah. So analytics don't give you both sides of the story. Right? It gives you a percentage of what might happen, but it doesn't tell you what the consequence is. So the way I always tried to make decisions was, it wasn't just by gut. It was by, okay, you analyze the situation. Okay, just like, I don't know if you guys remember, but we played Clemson in 2016 in the national championship game. And in the second half, it was like a basketball game. Whoever got the ball scored. So we went up by 4 points. I say, we got to go up by 2 scores to win the game. So we onside kicked. And everybody said, how could you do that? Well, we know by the way they lined up on their kickoff return that the onside kick was going to work. All right, so everybody says that was a huge risk. Well, it was a minimal risk because the players could execute it. We'd practiced it. And we knew from wasn't analytics, because percentage-wise of getting an onside kick, it's only like 7% you can get an onside kick. But we knew based on the circumstances that we could get this onside kick. So that didn't have anything to do with analytics. There was preparation involved in that, all right? And we took the risk out of it by knowing what the circumstance was. Does that make sense? Like it's 4th and 3, and you know they're going to play man-to-man. So you run a pick flat route. Well, you know, all they got to do is throw and catch it. I mean, I could throw it, I could catch it. So you've taken some of the risk out because you know the circumstance of what you have to solve the issue and the problem at hand. Does that make sense? All right, so just like I don't want to be critical, all right, because I take responsibility for this, but we have 4th and 3 at the 3 against Michigan in overtime. All right, we should have had a run-pass package. Okay, so we call a play. It's the right look for us to make this play work. Michigan calls timeout. The next time we have a play called, it's the wrong look for our play to work. We call timeout. So I'm saying, look, rather than having a right look and a wrong look, why don't we have a play, it's a run that has a pass built into it, so if they're going to blitz or whatever and get single coverage, we're going to take the best advantage we can take. Offensive coordinator says, well, we didn't practice that. And I'm saying, well, we're Russian roulette here, rolling the dice as to whether we're going to get the right look or the wrong look because we're out of timeouts. So we ran a play. They blitzed. We didn't even make it. But we'd have had single coverage on our best receiver because when they blitz, it is signal coverage, and we'd have had a better chance of throwing and catching the ball to that guy. Makes sense? So we didn't use good sense in making the decision, and it cost us the game.
Right. So it's not just about, it's not just an analytics or gut. It's also the practice and the preparation that goes into executing each and every one of the plays.
Exactly. And what advantage and disadvantage do you create by the process that you've created to know whether it's going to work or not? Now, and I'm not saying you don't take statistics into account, but I think in business, and that's why I use the three different types of leaderships. And my partner in our businesses, I always have to say, you're getting too transactional. You know, everything's based on how much money we made this month or how many cars we sold or what the margin is on the cars and all that. Well, let's go back to the people selling them. And what do we have to do to get them to do it right? And how about the service? You know, are we getting good reports on what we're doing? So is the process actually, so we'll create the value by getting the process right. But in a lot of times in business, we're always looking at the people say, look at the bottom line, look at the bottom line, look at the bottom line. I'm saying don't look at the bottom line, look at what makes the bottom line.
Right. You optimize for the inputs. We have right here, yes.
So in this room, there's a lot of high achieving contractors, some of which I would put in the contracting world the same level as you in the sports world. For you and successful people, the horizon is always moving. They're always chasing the horizon. So how do you decide when you've gone far enough? How did you decide that?
I never looked at it that way. You're a contractor?
We're all contractors.
If you build a bad house?
Say again?
You're a contractor, right?
We don't build houses, yeah. But yeah.
No, but I'm saying if you build a bad house, you got to live in it, right? So you got to live with the consequences of what you do. So I never looked at it like an accumulation of what you accomplished. I always looked at, okay, this season is over. The next day, the next season starts. And the next season is a total new challenge to try to get that team, that leadership, those people in the right places to do the right things so that we can see if they can reach their full potential and we can do a great job with that team. So it was a totally different challenge. And I looked at it like people said, you stayed at Alabama for 17 years. You could have went to all these pro teams and you could have done this. But I looked at it like I was starting a new team every year. I was starting, it was a new challenge every year. That was my way of not being complacent. Does that make sense?
How did you decide that last year was your last season, though?
So I always had it in my mind that I never wanted to ride the program down. In other words, my effectiveness started to diminish. Mm. And I think when people started, every recruit that we recruited asked me, I'm 72 years old, said, will you be here for my whole career? And it got harder and harder for me to make those commitments that I'm going to be 76 when this guy's a senior. Does that make sense? And then coaches started to leave because they were afraid I was going to retire. And then the people that I tried to replace them with kept asking that same question. If I come here, will you be here until my daughter, who's a freshman in high school, graduates from school? So now it's affecting who I can bring to the organization from a recruiting standpoint for players and coaches. And I don't want to ride the program down. So I thought that it is inevitable that I have to retire at some point in time. I can't do this forever. And so I thought this was the right time. And I do think that, you know, the environment in college football right now is not one that can help you sustain success. because it's not about creating value, it's about how much money you can make. So the whole dynamic of college athletics has changed in the last 3 years. Now, I'm not saying it's good, bad, or indifferent, I'm just saying it all changed. So if you're not at a school that has a whole bunch of money, you can buy a championship now. There are people that are buying a championship. They're investing a whole bunch of money and paying players. So people that have great fan bases and their whole process was creating value for players, which is what we always tried to do. My theory was you go to college to create value for your future. You go to college to prepare yourself for the day you can't play football. Well, that's all changed now. So the things that we always created value in were less important. Because now it's how much money can I make? How much are you going to pay me? It's different. Different culture. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm just saying it's different. But that's what I always believed in. That's why I like college better than pro ball.
Did it create challenges for you to recruit later as the NIL stuff came in?
Yeah. For 3 years, we managed NIL really, really well. So we won even with that. We won in 2020 with it. A national championship. You know, we won the SEC championship this year with it. But can you sustain it? It's going to be harder to sustain. And I don't think it's good for the players. I don't think it's good for college football, but that's a whole other subject.
I think we have one at the back. Yeah, right here.
So in football, you have an off season. You have the advantage of an off season. You have 6 a.m.s and mat drills and 7-on-7s, all that stuff. And you can filter out your talent, right? So you know who is maybe talented, who's going to give great effort, and you can coach to that. We don't necessarily always have the advantage of an offseason. You know, we hire somebody and they're going into the game right now. So given the choice, if you had somebody with 100% talent and 80% effort, or 80% talent, but you knew he was going to give 100%, who are you putting on the field?
Well, I think that there's no perfect people. There's no perfect players. There's no perfect coach. There's no perfect anything. So regardless of whether the talent was here and the effort was here, or the talent was here or the effort was here and the talent was here, who was most effective in terms of that balance? And that's something that you would have to evaluate, that I would have to evaluate. But I think there's a point of diminishing returns. I think at 80% versus 100%, both people probably work. But what's the diminishing return when you only have 60% talent and 100% effort and your talent's not good enough? Like, and what I would tell you to do when you get to that point is recruit better. See, the one thing that people misunderstand about me more than anything else is I was a great recruiter. Look at all the great players. You know, they never had a Heisman Trophy winner at Alabama, and we had four in the years that I was there. We had like 79 All-Americans or something. We recruited those people. Those were the right kind of people with the right kind of talent as well as the right kind of attitude to build a program, because I realized a long time ago I could not coach a bad player to play good. So I figured out, go recruit some good players.
Right in the back, yes.
Coach Saban, yes. First of all, I'm one of, if not the only Bama boy in here, so roll damn Tide, okay? Second, this is about thwarting powerful pressure. So a lot of guys in here are owned by private equity, and a lot of pressure comes from private equity. I know Father Holloway personally that was on the field with you every single game. And I know that your faith played a pretty big part in what you did there at Alabama. A lot of guys in here have a lot of strong faith, and there's a lot of pressure to remove that from the business. So the question to you is, being a man of faith, first of all, how did that affect the team? And secondly, how did you push off that pressure to change who Nick Saban is from the powers that be? How did you deal with that?
Let me put it this way. I never ever read the newspaper. I never listened to what people had to say on the radio or television. But regardless of all that, I probably put more pressure on myself to try to get it right than anybody else could put on me. In other words, you've heard me use the word rat poison. It's how you let external factors affect you. And I learned this when I was a head coach at Michigan State. We had a kicker, and he was a really good kicker, but he choked. All right, so he missed like three kicks that would have won games. So the press was on me, even though this guy was a young guy and I knew he was the right guy, he's the right talent, had the right stuff. You know, one time was a bad hold, one time was a bad snap, but they're blaming the kicker, and the press is putting all kind of pressure on me to change kickers. So I changed kickers, and the next guy is worse than the first guy. And I said, I should never make a choice and decision because of what somebody else thinks. And I'm never going to do that again. So I eliminated all this rat poison, external factors, because it can be good or it can be bad. But if it affects you either way, you're in trouble. Because if it's good and you're satisfied, you're in trouble. If it's bad and you're frustrated, you're in trouble. All right, so I just never ever felt any pressure at all, because it never came from anybody else. It just came from what I thought we needed to do to have the best organization, the best program, get the team ready the best way, the best practice, whatever we had to do to get them to reach their full potential. And that's what I stayed focused on. I think pressure comes from being outcome oriented. You know, you got to win the game. When you start thinking like that, or you say, I want everybody to compete in the game 100% of the time, each play like it has a history and life of its own, and have discipline to execute and do their job. If that's your focus, you're not worried about the outcome of the game. It's more fun to play the game that way, and it's more fun to coach it, because you're not worried about the outcome. You're worried about the things you need to do to get the outcome. And if you take your situation and you stay focused on what you need to do to make it right and make it work, then you're not. And you got to have faith, trust, and confidence in that. And if you have faith, trust, and confidence in it, then you believe in it. Now, is it always going to be successful? No. No, it's not always going to be successful. But if you have good process, it'll be more successful than not. So you will be able to make good decisions and choices based on not emotional decisions, but decisions that are based on fact and things that you believe in. You know, we should never make emotional decisions. Now, it's one of the things that I tell the players all the time. We want you to play with great intensity, but never make an emotional decision. When you get emotional, you don't have a brain. You know, you make bad choices and bad decisions. That's why people get penalties. That's why people do dumb stuff, because they make emotional decisions. So try to stay away from that part of it and stay focused on the process. And I think you eliminate the pressure, because you believe in what you believe in. You know, and I feel sorry for maybe a lot of people in this room too, but I tell the players this all the time. I feel sorry for you guys, because all you do is look at your phone, running into the wall, worrying about what everybody else thinks. Even though this guy may be some fat guy in his underwear in his basement, you still think about what he thinks is important. And it's not. It's not important at all.
Right on. I think we have one right here.
Coach, we all work on building cultures in our companies, and I've struggled trying to figure out, because I listened to the guy in his basement, his underwear, and I thought you were coming to Texas. What was it at Texas that you didn't like about the culture that kept you at Bama?
You know, I never, ever talked to Texas. A lot of these things are created by the media, and a lot of them happen on the internet, and they get started on the internet. And no disrespect, but then people like you think it's really happening. And I never ever talked to Texas. I never had any intention of going there. I mean, Mac Brown was a friend of mine. you know, I wasn't going to talk to anybody there until he wasn't the coach there anymore, and just never ever considered it. But it was the same thing. I felt like the next year is a challenge at Alabama, so why do I need to go someplace else to have the same challenge that I could have in the program that I was in? Now, I didn't always think that way. All right, so, you know, I was successful at LSU and went to the Miami Dolphins, which was the worst. Like, Wayne Huizenga was a great owner, but they had the worst salary cap, the worst record, the oldest team, no draft picks. I mean, you couldn't add it up to me any worse situation to go to. No quarterback. But I thought it was the next challenge. So, but after that, I said, I'll be satisfied with whatever challenge I have, because it was difficult to overcome because you couldn't control all the variables. So.
All right. Do we have one? Where do we have one? Right here.
Hey, Coach. Great to meet you. Mine's really a follow-up question, because I think you answered what my question would have been around NIL and portal and how you feel about it. So I think that we heard that. Follow-up to that is, where do you think it goes from here? I mean, is it sustainable, what the NCAA has done?
Yeah, well, first of all, this is not an NCAA issue, in my opinion. I mean, people blame the NCAA because it's a direct result of what's happening in college football. But the legal system created all these issues. And what happened is the NCAA couldn't enforce their own rules. So that's what created the circumstance that we're in now. And I don't think that there's any competitive venue anywhere in the world that doesn't have guidelines that manages some kind of parity. NFL, for example, you got a salary cap, people have contracts, you win, you draft late, you lose, you draft early, you play a harder schedule if you win, you play an easier schedule if you lose. All this is to create parity. Parity creates fan interest. If everybody in the NFL was 8-8 after 16 weeks of the season, every fan base would be going to the game, drinking beer, doing all the things, interested in the outcome. Correct? Well, that's what parity is. What we have in college football now is you can buy a team because there's no contracts, players are all free agents, and whoever wants to spend the most money on buying players, which they've said is legal through a collective, then you're going to have the best opportunity to win because you're going to end up having the best players unless you choose bad guys. And most of the guys at the places that have the money are pretty good coaches that have a chance to make good choices and decisions. So you're going to create this in college football. You're going to have a few haves, and you're going to have a whole lot of have-nots. So if we don't put some guidelines on what's happening, and I don't think it's good for the players. You know, your chances of graduating go down about 25% every time you transfer. And like our graduation rate at Alabama was 85%. Would have been 97% if you didn't count the guys that went out early for the draft that could have graduated in a year if they'd have stayed in school. So we took pride in creating value on and off the field with our players. We had a lot of personal development programs that helped them have successful sort of mindset of what they had to do to be successful. So, and we wanted to help them develop as football players. Well, that doesn't exist now because they leave as soon as you pay them more money. Mm. And it's kind of a shame. Now, I think the quality of life for players should be better than what it was. So the players should have some opportunity to have a good quality of life relative to their scholarship, because it is big business. But how you get that done is a whole nother conversation. I had opinions about it, but I've been to the U.S. Senate and the House twice, talked to the leaders of both, trying to get some legal action from a government standpoint, whether it's antitrust or whatever it needs to be, to control this in a way that is tolerable for everything. Because you got a lot of issues. You got Title IX issues. I mean, if we play the players in football or the revenue sports, we still should be paying the non-revenue sports. All right, so there's a lot of issues that go into this that we've taken the college model and tried to make it a semi-professional model. And it just doesn't work very well until we put some guidelines on it that helps us make it work.
Did we run out of time? Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, please a warm applause for Coach David.
Thank you very much.
Listeners, thank you so much again for listening to this podcast week after week. We are extremely grateful. Again, the whole purpose of this podcast is to give back to the home services industry that we love so much, whether you're a rhino or not. We really, really appreciate all the subscribers. And if you haven't subscribed yet, please go in and subscribe and you'll get all the episodes sent to you automatically weekly. Also, we have really enjoyed your feedback. It's so meaningful for us when we get to read the nice comments that you guys put. So keep doing that. And if you don't know how to do it, here's what you got to do. You search for To The Point Home Services on Apple Podcasts. You click on our profile, scroll all the way down to the bottom, and hit write a review. And be honest and share your story and how the podcast has impacted you and your business. Thanks again from the bottom of our hearts at To The Point Home Services Podcast. We appreciate you.